I probably don't need to tell you that I'm Sparkplug Coffee's number one fan. In fact, I love that freshly roasted premium coffee so much that I would happily nurse it back to health in my secluded farmhouse far from the prying eyes of the dirty birds who would separate us. Why? Because Sparkplug is always made with fair trade premium Arabica beans. It comes in blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this fantastic coffee to you in Canada and the US within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. It's not a Coffee of the Month club, it's completely flexible and customizable. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's TOP100PROJECT, it's not case sensitive, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order. So what are you waiting for? Bitchly Coffee is waiting for you at your Christly convenience at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100 Project
and action.
Hello, one and all, and thank you for revving up the 363rd Ellis's Analysis, the Monday morning glimpse at movies from long ago. Speaking of long ago, the first thing we did in the podcasting world was to review every Christing one of the greats on the AFI's 1998 and 2007 groupings of 100 awesomest American films. Nearly every episode on this channel has had spoilers, and this episode will be no different. So stop listening now if spoilers make you feel all oogie. I'm the dirty bird who hosts this bitchly podcast and who, just like Annie Wilkes, will call someone a cocksucker when I'm trying to murder them. And here's my cock-a-doody co-host who keeps me drugged up on pain pills, my wife Bev.
That's me.
Or maybe I'm keeping myself drugged up on pain pills. Wait, no, that's... hang on. Whiskey?
Yeah.
Ah, delicious. Okay, the coming attractions trivia question. A trivia question this time. It's about the Oscars. That's usually my favorite go-to. Many of Stephen King's books have been adapted into movies, and many of them have been nominated for Oscars. Carrie got a couple nominations. Shawshank got several nominations. The Green Mile, of course, Misery. How many of King's book adaptations have won Oscars?
Misery is the only movie based on a Stephen King novel that's ever won an Oscar of any kind.
Isn't that surprising? Especially Shawshank.
Yes!
People would probably expect that had to have won something, but it was shut out with 7 nominations in 94. The Green Mile, I think, had 5, including both of those Best Picture nominations. No directing nominations for Darabont either time, but anyway, Carrie, of course, the 2 acting nominations. This had an acting nomination, and of course, the only time a King adaptation ever won an Academy Award.
It's amazing. He's somewhat responsible for so many classic films now. The Academy just doesn't seem to want to recognize it. Even when you say they've had a ton of nominations, calling it a ton is pretty generous when you consider how many adaptations there are and how many are beloved, great movies.
Pet Sematary could have got something maybe for the cinematography, the makeup, the effects, that kind of thing. The Shining, of course, before that. How did The Shining not get nominations? Instead, it got Razzie nominations for Kubrick and I think for Shelley Duvall. Creepshow for the makeup as well. That was probably a worthy choice. And of course, the recent It movies, visual effects, possibly again, makeup would have been a worthy nom. But
maybe even performances. There were certainly some popular performances in that first movie.
But Kathy Bates in this film, the only time. Okay, The Miz was released by Columbia nearly 30 years ago on November 30th, 1990. It tripled its budget, so it was a tidy little hit for Rob Reiner's Castle Rock production company. And he got that name from Stand By Me, which was also written by Stephen King. Oh, there you go. We forgot Stand By Me got nominated for the screenplay.
Oh, okay.
It didn't win, though, still. Yeah. So the point remains that it was only Misery that ever won. But anyway, Stand By Me, The Body, short story that King wrote, is where Reiner got Castle Rock from, because that is the town. I think often a town in King's stories is Castle Rock.
Yeah, Rob Reiner had worked with King before on Stand By Me, and he had worked with William Goldman before on Princess Bride, and then he got William Goldman to adapt Misery for this film.
Okay then, Bev, for those who may not remember what this 30-year-old movie is about, please give them the skinny on Misery.
James Caan is Paul Sheldon, the writer of a blockbuster series of pulpy romance novels about a character named Misery Chastain. After a grisly car crash, Paul wakes up in the home of Kathy Bates' Annie Wilkes, a retired nurse who rescued him from the deadly crash and is nursing his injuries. She also happens to be his number one fan. She really, really, really loves his books, and she loves him, and gosh, her phone is down, and the roads are closed, and his legs are broken, and I guess she'll just have to look after him forever and ever and... wait, wrong Stephen King movie. Cracks in Annie's psyche don't take long to appear, and Paul, completely at her mercy, has to find a way out.
Or, in a nutshell, elderly law enforcement officer reads romance novels for work. Yeah, just for work. He's yanking it. Buster, what a well-played character by Richard Farnsworth. He and Frances Sternhagen have a great relationship in this movie. She's so horny for him. When you're in this car, that means you're an officer of the law.
Maybe that's why he was reading romance novels, because he knew he was going to lose his wife if he didn't find some way to spice it up.
And unfortunately, she loses him.
Yeah.
He is murdered by someone who should not have access to guns. She has both a shotgun and a handgun. A shotgun out in the country, okay, I can understand that. My dad had some of those. I don't think he does anymore, but he did when he lived in the country, when they lived in the country, my parents. But a handgun, she shouldn't have that. But that's America for you.
Yeah, even serial killers are allowed to have guns.
Okay, there's a lot of plaudits for this movie. Let's get through them here. Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 90% of critics like this film. 60 fresh, 7 rotten, for an average of 7.5 out of 10, and 89% of audiences. Well, those are pretty excellent scores, again, for a King movie, because a lot of them were pretty crappy. He's such a visual writer. When he writes, you can see, at least I can, so often when he's putting those, even the lesser books sometimes. But rarely have his movies actually been very good. We talked about the Oscar nominations. Well, most of the movies that have been adapted from his books have not been very good movies to begin with.
When you read his books, it feels like you're watching a movie. But he also can get away with some pretty far-fetched stuff in his books that right. I don't think always translates to the screen.
Dreamcatcher is one of the worst movies I've ever seen. And that was a book by Stephen King.
Yeah, it was a pretty mediocre book. Listen, okay. I read it. There's a reason it didn't make the greatest movie.
Misery was 61st at the 1990 U.S. box office. Home Alone was number one. Ghosts was number two. Dances with Wolves was number three. Pretty Woman was number four. And Total Recall was number seven. We've covered all of those except Home Alone. And by the time we get into Christmas season, we'll probably have done that one too. 1990 was a pretty good year for films, and we've done many of them. And others before that. I can't think of one right now. But I know we've covered more than just those. So Goodfellas, I didn't mention that. That was, of course, on the AFI list and one of the great films of all time. We already said the movie won an Oscar, of course, for Bates, Best Actress, beating out Julia Roberts, Meryl Streep, Joanne Woodward, and Angelica Houston. All good performances, in fact, and if any one of them had won, Streep probably wouldn't have won for Postcards from the Edge. And when you look at the list of people that could have played this character, Angelica Houston's one of those, but she passed on it for The Grifters. The one I liked the most of that list, by the way, Jessica Lange was a possibility to play the character. Lange would have been good, but the one I liked the most would have been Bette Midler. Wouldn't have had the same physicality, and Kathy Bates looks so much like Annie Wilkes is described in the book, and Midler not at all, but Midler could be, I think, pretty scary, and also, as Kathy Bates in this film, quite funny.
I feel like Kathy Bates really walks this great tightrope between commitment to this really extreme and at times very ridiculous character, mm-hmm. but never crossing over the edge to straight comedy.
True, that's true. I'm just saying other people that were considered that would have been good choices, and if Bates didn't exist or they didn't cast her, would have been fine. But maybe the movie wouldn't have such legendary status now, including being on an AFI list. It was 17th on the evil side of the top 100 heroes and villains list, because, of course, that is Annie Wilkes. Hannibal Lecter was number one on that list, and 17th is not bad to be there, because she is in some pretty rarefied air, being in the top 20. We talked a minute ago about the Oscars, and this was the rare Oscar for a horror or thriller film ever. Jaws won technicals. It's a thriller horror, and so did The Exorcist. Thriller horror, that's obviously a horror film. But the very next year after this, Silence of the Lambs goes on to win the Big Five. Picture, director, actor, actress, and adapted screenplay. Only three movies ever have done that. And again, that stereotype. Horrors, well, thrillers even, can't win Oscars. But the year after this movie, that one won five awards. Misery is also nominated for the Top 100 Thrills and the Top 100 Quotes with, of course, you can guess it before I even say it, I'm your number one fan, and that would have been a very worthy choice. It isn't overdone, this movie, but it is said many times, including at the end, by the dessert cart waitress, who doesn't seem anywhere near as insane as Kathy Bates does in this movie, but who knows, maybe she's nuts too. In fact, I'll just do the what happens next right now, since we're talking about the dessert cart waitress. Paul sticks a steak knife in that dessert waitress's jugular, just to be sure. He can't take the risk. She's dead. Okay, well, what'd you think of Misery?
I like Misery a lot, but I wouldn't say I love it. I think when it came out, the story felt really innovative and fresh, but now that's worn off a little. The appeal is somewhat less obvious, but it's still a really effective and well-made thriller. Paul's predicament is a perfect trap, and it's really fun to watch him try everything to survive and escape. But best of all is this wonderfully bizarre dialogue that Kathy Bates pulls off with perfect commitment, giving us so many perfect phrases, like, of course, I'm your number one fan, or my personal favorite, you know what I'm going to say.
He didn't get out of the cock-a-doodie car!
Which we say every time we're talking about a movie and trying to explain that something was dumb and overwritten or pandered to the audience in a stupid way.
Or not playing fair, which is her point.
That's right. That's a better way to describe it. Anytime that scenario happens that she describes, we just always use that as shorthand for a movie that was poorly written, essentially.
She is criticizing him because when he has to write Misery Returns, according to her, he's cheating. She's a great example of a fan that knows more about the thing that he created than he does. Because I think it's right before that she's talking about all the things about Misery and I forget the two men, Ian and Winthorne, right. Jamie Caan has to underplay so much in this movie. And I don't know if he loved doing it. He's not the kind of actor that wants to lay in a bed for most of a movie. Maybe that's why it's good casting, too. The actor and the character want to get up and do something, be physical, but they can't because he's got severely broken legs. But I like the way Caan plays that moment, almost as if to say, I made all this, and you know all that? The other thing, of course, that's going on here is King is writing about his own fans. Clearly, he's experienced this kind of stuff, not being imprisoned by somebody who might kill him, but just the fact that they won't let you do anything else. You got to write the thriller type stuff because Paul Sheldon wants to write his own story, his own life, and the four-letter words that's in Fast Cars. That's what it is in the book. In the movie, it's just Untitled, that new book he has that she makes him burn. And he wants to do what he wants to do, but the fans won't let him. And that can be a little terrifying, I'm sure, for somebody as famous and popular as Stephen King. And the other subtext with this is that Annie Wilkes represents his alcoholism, meaning Stephen King's alcoholism. And he felt hobbled, one of the most famous scenes in movie history, probably, by the booze.
Was this book written before or after his car accident?
It was 87. I think his accident was in the 90s.
Oh, okay. Interesting that he almost in a way prophesizes that.
Well, speaking of that, Paul has champagne when he finishes the book at the beginning of the movie and then drives off into what ends up being a pretty bad snowstorm. A, he should have stayed another night, obviously. But B, is he drunk? Is he drunk driving?
Oh, maybe. He shouldn't be driving in that storm, in that car.
Aggressively,
without
too.
Without snow tires. Yeah, aggressively. Everything he's doing is kind of stupid and
I think maybe he's liquored up, though, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, you might be right. If he never, ever drinks, then he would have very little tolerance for it. So, yeah, you have a good point. You talk about how Stephen King can't escape the fans and this journey to try and escape the genre that he's famous for. Well, Stephen King wrote 4 novellas under his pen name to get away from his own persona. You and I are both huge fans of these books. Under the name Richard Bachman, he wrote The Long Walk, which is our favorite, mm-hmm. Rage, mm-hmm. about a school shooting, which was also prophetic. Road Work and, oh my God, I'm forgetting it, the one that they made a movie out of.
Oh, did they? That's the least memorable one to me.
But what's it called? The one with Schwarzenegger?
I don't remember right now. Oh, The Running Man? That's part of that?
Yeah, isn't it? Ooh, I hope I'm right, but I think that The Running Man is one of the Bachman books.
I like The Running Man book a lot. The movie is fun, but the book is really effective, I think. Oh. I read that a long time ago. And Rage is almost the Jeremy song by Pearl Jam. If you listen to Jeremy...
Isn't Jeremy written about that book?
Oh, maybe it is. I didn't know that.
Both Rage and Long Walk. When I was like a tween, I read both of those books. The Long Walk, I couldn't count how many times I read it. I was mildly obsessed with it. It's my favorite thing he's ever written. By a country mile, actually.
If I were to ever write a screenplay, and adapt one, I guess, especially, it would be The Long Walk.
Good luck getting someone to make it for you.
I don't know how you'd ever do it, because the budget would be huge, because you'd have to have all these locations. You could cheat a lot of it, and I've thought of how you could cheat a lot of the deaths. You could have them happen off screen. It could be the sound. You could probably do it, but you'd have to have a big budget, and you'd also have to have an awful lot of killing. You could maybe avoid showing some of it, but you're pretty much getting an R rating, and then you got to get a big budget from a studio with an R rated film, and that is not easy anymore. But yes, The Long Walk is one of the best things he ever wrote. But let's get back to the story. We talked about how he was an alcoholic at this point, and also a drug addict, because what's the one that's about his drug addiction, supposedly? Maximum Overdrive, maybe? Well, he made that when he was coked up. That's what it was. One of them is supposed to be about his drug addiction as well. Anyway, speaking of bottles with booze, this is almost a bottle episode of a movie, although not completely, because you got Buster's investigation, which we go back to quite a few times in the film, and we see him with his wife, including at home in bed. But generally, the movie is in Annie's house, and for so much of the film, especially the first half, it's only in that one bedroom.
It could be mistaken for a play.
It was a play.
Well, it makes total sense. Seeing this movie,
after this,
it'd be so easy to turn this into a play. There's only 4 actors, essentially. Well, that's not true. 5, because of his book agent. And even his book agent, I feel like you could get away without that. And a handful of locations, but mostly it takes place in one room.
You know who the 2 actors were in the play? And there's probably been more than one adaptation of that play, but the one I was reading about? Bruce Willis. Interesting choice for Paul. I think a pretty good choice. And Laurie Metcalf.
Really?
She could really do the insane stuff, probably do the funny stuff, but doesn't have the physicality, so I'd have been curious how they would do the big fight at the end, because Bruce Willis would hand her ass to her. I can believe that Kathy Bates, if she really fought Jimmy Khan, she'd lose, but she'd stand a bit of a chance for a little while, and at the end, the big fight they do have, it's fairly believable. He's still recovering from a bad accident, too. But Bruce Willis would destroy Larry Metcalf in a fight. So that's the one thing. Maybe they don't have them fist fight and tumble around and all that at the end. Maybe he's supposed to be still badly hurt and he's barely recovered. Because in this, Paul is pretty much back to normal, even though she hobbled him past the halfway point of the film. And he's got to re-recover his now ankles, not even his legs so much.
Yeah, but his upper body is fine and he could figure something out.
So Misery is set in Colorado, as was, of course, The Shining. But filmed in Nevada and California, and also a little bit in New York City, as we see at the very end. Lauren Bacall's scenes are there. I'm sure she actually was there. Maybe she was in California, I guess. I don't know. She doesn't really have any outside scenes, I guess. You see her early on. You see her a little bit in the middle, in offices all the time, and a restaurant. Lauren Bacall, by the way, we've never covered her before.
No, isn't that
funny? Interesting? This was her 45th or 46th year making movies. She started in the mid-40s. This is 1990. She only died a few years ago. She didn't make that many films, and we've never covered one until right now. And she's barely in this, so to call it a Lauren Bacall film is not even true. And they did shoot from February to the end of May 1990, so they got legit snow. I didn't read anything about how they had trouble getting snow. So many times people do movies that are supposed to be about snow, like Fargo, and then they can't get actual snow. The Revenant, they talked about that too.
Well, there's the scene when Buster's going to check out the car. He gets stuck waist high in snow, and as two people who grew up in Canada, we know exactly what that's like. If you grew up around snow, you know that's exactly what it's like to get that stuck. Mm-hmm. And you can get really stuck in snow like that. It can actually be a physical challenge to get out of a pit like that.
For an older man, too. Mm-hmm. That's a really well shot scene, too, because the camera pans down and shows just how close he was to discovering that car at that moment. Rob Reiner, of course, was the comedy guy all through the 80s. Started his career directing with This Is Spinal Tap, one of the most classic comedies of all time. And apart from The Sure Thing, which is fine, I don't have a problem with that movie, not one of my favorites though. What a run that was.
Oh my God.
Talked about this in other movies we've covered of Reiner. So let's exclude The Sure Thing. Spinal Tap, Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, and A Few Good Men. North was terrible, and then The American President, which is pretty good too. After that, nothing very good.
I wouldn't say he fell off a cliff. It was like a slow descent, but how he could have made such incredible films for this one decade and then lose his touch.
And he's still working now. He's still directing movies. I haven't seen the one he did with Woody Harrelson about LBJ, but I do want to see that one. The Bucket List was fine. It wasn't great, but two excellent actors, Nicholson and Freeman, working together. But it's funny how he could be so awesome for such a short period of time, about 10 years. Some of the best films of that era made by one guy. But the common theme there, apart from Misery and A Few Good Men, I guess, too, which both have comedy, is that they're comedies. Now, he's made comedies since that have failed, granted. But he also started making more extravagant big films like A Few Good Men, American President, bigger cast than he often worked with. And maybe that's part of the problem. He got out of his wheelhouse and got a little too grandiose. I like Rob Reiner. Seems like a good guy, very political on Twitter. But maybe that's part of the problem. It's funny he could lose his touch that much, not even have one or two here and there. We think, like we talked about Polanski when we did Repulsion last week, where even in the modern era, he's made a Carnage or a Ghost Rider, which were very good films. The Pianist as well. That was a great film. But all through his career, he's had plenty of meh or even terrible movies.
Hits and misses.
But Reiner has pretty much only had misses since The American President.
And I consider him one of the best directors of the 80s. I think he's my favorite director of popcorn films. He's a real crowd pleaser, and he hits all of my favorite notes. And I think he deserves credit for having one of history's greatest sensibilities for what makes a film watchable. His pacing and economy of story is like a Swiss watch. When Harry Met Sally is the world's greatest example of economic storytelling. As an editor, I feel like I could watch that film every day and learn more about my craft. Misery was his first non-comedy film, depending on how you might categorize Stand By Me. But it was certainly a departure anyway, and his comedy instincts must have been an asset when he was determining just how extreme he could make Annie Wilkes without tipping the scales from scary to funny. But at the same time, is this as good as his comedies? No. It's a very good film. But it doesn't have the magic and the sparkle of his earlier comedies.
Okay. I was impressed, actually, that a guy who'd never made anything like this before could do it so well. Could ratchet up the tension when he needs to. He can make her scary. And that's a big part of Bates' performance, that she can do that, too. But the way they combine, and Goldman writing it, King writing the book, all of them deserve credit, and Khan for playing off her, to make her frightening when she needs to be, including accidentally on purpose spilling gas on him If you don't burn your book that I don't like, then I'm going to burn you. So obviously, again, Khan's got to underplay what he's seeing, which is, oh, shit, I have to do this. And I have to be careful when I do it because I don't want to light myself on fire. But I'm impressed that he could do a thriller like this effectively after doing the comedy films, because it wasn't his wheelhouse. And that was part of the point, I guess, for him, is let me try something a little bit different. I really like this movie from the standpoint of enjoyability. Those other ones are more enjoyable because they're just great comedies. But this is a movie I wanted to watch 3 or 4 months ago. It was on demand. I don't think they have it on demand anymore. We saw our DVD. But I didn't watch it because I knew we were going to watch it for Scary Movie Month. And there's not a lot of movies I've seen on demand where it's, I really want to see it, but I'll wait type of thing. And it's not even one of his very best. I think that's a great mark for this thriller, that I want to see it that much. That, no. Hold off. Be patient.
Watchability, I'm telling you. He just has one of the world's greatest talents for watchability. You know who else is like that? Zemeckis. Zemeckis, even his worst films are the types of movies that once you start watching them, you can't stop because they just have that forward momentum. And it's obviously not as easy as it looks because so many films fail on that account. You were talking about how he made Annie evil. One of my criticisms, it's a small criticism of the film, but I think it would have been so much more interesting if Annie had initially been presented as Paul's hero. Sure, she could have been a little kooky and had idiosyncrasies, but we forgive all kinds of stuff like that when we're presented with a character who does something heroic like she did. She saves his life. She didn't cause a car accident. If she had not been stalking him, he would have died.
Isn't that ironic?
It is ironic. And how much more interesting would the film be if we had begun feeling sympathetic towards her and then discovered with Paul that he was at the mercy of an obsessed serial killer? And instead, they made the choice to accompany her immediately by this ominous score and this strange off-putting close-ups and that first line and that ethereal echoey repeat of, I'm your biggest fan. You're supposed to be afraid of her immediately. And I just feel like they tipped their hand. It's not the wrong approach exactly, but it's a missed opportunity. And it makes me think of another thriller that came out in the early 90s, a couple years after this, with a few similarities. And that is Single White Female, which we rewatched. We just had all this COVID time to kill, and that was one of the movies that we put in the roster. And yeah, it's kind of dumb, but talk about watchability. It's a great thriller. And for the first act of the film, we're very much on the side of the character that turns out to be the villain. And that's a film that was clear from all the promotional materials. Jennifer Jason Leigh was the villain, but she does such a great job of turning all those performance ticks that ought to be red flags into just quirks that almost makes her more sympathetic until, of course, it's too late. And we discover that she's evil when Bridget Fonda discovers she's evil.
Yeah, I think you're right about the camera shots. Barry Sonnenfeld shot this. This was the last year he was a cinematographer. In fact, this is the last movie because he did Miller's Crossing this year, too, the last movie he ever made for the Coens. And then Misery was technically the last movie that got released that he shot. Became a director himself, of course, on Adam's Family the year after this. But maybe they are doing a little bit too much of that crazy, blood, simple stuff with the camera. But I think the first time the movie is clearly evident that she's lying to Paul and making sure that we know that she's lying to Paul is when she drives by Buster investigating the car and not quite seeing the car is right there, about 10 feet away, and it's a little further down. Because she should know. I think it's clearly a police 4x4, whatever you call it, SUV they're driving around. And she doesn't stop and say a thing. So I think Reiner is saying, now you know. Also, in fairness to them, this was a Stephen King book only a few years before. And it is interesting whenever a movie presents as if nobody knows the big twist in the early part of the film, not the end twist necessarily of something, but in the first 20 minutes that this person's really there, that this person's dead, that this person's, his father from long ago. When it's something that's well-known in pop culture because of a book or a play or it's a remake or something. So it's almost like an insult to us when they do that. So maybe that's what they're going for here too. She is, actually, I'll say it, even though I think her performance is excellent, a little over the top. But she's playing an insane woman, and I think you have to give somebody leeway when they're playing an insane woman. Heath Ledger playing the Joker, or Jack Nicholson the year before this playing the Joker, every Joker performance really, is definitely over the top. But I think it's very appropriate for what they're doing. I would say this is actually the same kind of thing here with Bates.
There was a lot of hyperbole at the time about Kathy Bates' performance as Annie Wilkes and that she was this incredible actress. And I, for one, don't think that she really lived up to that promise after Misery. I always find her acting to be very charismatic, but never that believable. She's very fun to watch. But I never get emotionally lost in a Kathy Bates performance. It always feels a little acty to me.
Maybe stage actress,
she
might be part of it.
She started on the stage. She never really lost that sensibility of playing to the cheap seats. And in that sense, I think that Bates lets us down a little in the quiet moments of this film. when she's trying to be sweet and calm, but just a little off-center enough to give us a hint of what's underneath. But if that's a trade-off, of course, for the way that she pulls off those big moments, then so be it. I don't need to see another actress ever try to match the way Kathy Bates calls somebody a dirty bird. Or that calm menace when she's methodically taking a sledgehammer to Paul's legs. When it comes to those big moments, which are what everybody remembers about the film, her performance is everything. And she was a nobody. Nobody knew her name before this movie came out. She may have been in movies before, but she came out of nowhere. James Caan also, people may have remembered him from The Godfather.
Oh, they did.
He was hardly an A-lister. He hadn't done much in between The Godfather.
Well, he kept making movies. Thief in 81. And he was in The Godfather Part 2, don't forget. He made movies, but yeah, he wasn't quite the same star he had been. That's another long list on the IMDb about who could have played this character. Warren Beatty, they talked to him forever about it, and he finally, well, apparently he never did turn them down, so they said he officially still isn't a no after all these decades. But I think Caan was a curious choice, and maybe in a lot of ways, like Bruce Willis would be on the stage, a great choice because he's not the most obvious person. It's almost like, I do have to get up and do something. Also, the actor doesn't like to rehearse, Caan doesn't, and Bates loves to rehearse because she's a stage actor, so that was also a bit of a, I wouldn't say a conflict exactly, but Reiner made them use that as well against each other. Bates, though, you talked about not really sinking into her characters. We did watch Primary Colors during the COVID times as well here this year. I think that's a character where she is pretty emotional. Probably too over the top, actually. Yeah. But when she is sad towards the end, bitching out John Travolta and Emma Thompson. Okay, yeah, I'm admitting it. It's pretty over the top. But still, like, a pretty strong performance.
Different roles call for different actors. She is just the type of actor that I'm never going to forget that she's acting. That's great when it's great, when it's what you need. But I'm the type of person that's going to have a hard time connecting with the performance if I'm always reminded that I'm watching a performance. Not to say that she doesn't have charisma to burn. She's such an interesting actress to watch on camera, but she has that weakness, in my opinion. I do disagree with you about James Caan as great casting here. The list
I don't know about
actors,
great. If I say great, I shouldn't say great.
Okay, I think you said he was pretty good. The list of actors that turned down this part: William Hurt, Kevin Kline, Michael Douglas, Harrison Ford, Dustin Hoffman, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Richard Dreyfuss, Warren Beatty, Gene Hackman, Robert Redford. Any of those actors in this role would have been a better movie. Sorry, James Caan.
Really?
Yes, James Caan is fine. And he has such a hard job because he spends most of his performance stuck in a bed. And his face has to do all the work of expressing his terror and his doubts and his pain.
Not much dialogue either for him.
Right. All while we, the audience, know that he has to keep all of his thoughts and feelings completely private from Annie, who has an unpredictable hair-triggered temper. So he has to find this balance between expressing his thoughts to the audience wordlessly and without body language, and also performing somebody who's trying to hide his feelings from his tormentor. That's an impossible thing to do, but I feel like James Caan just didn't try. There's scenes where he is so dramatically underreacting to his situation, and I never really felt that fear or peril, almost like he was too afraid to look like a sissy to express the terror of his predicament. I don't care how tough you are, even if you are Bruce Willis, if you have two broken legs and a messed up shoulder and you can't defend yourself and you're in agonizing pain and you would actually starve to death without the help of the person who's tormenting you, doesn't matter how much of a tough guy you are, you would be terrified. I kind of wish that I had seen more of that vulnerability that he didn't express. The physical stuff, when he does do it, phenomenal. Crawling around on one arm, trying to get through the kitchen. Those are such great nail-biting scenes. But all those scenes where he's interacting with Bates, who's so big, and he seems to be underdoing it.
He should, to work off of her.
Yeah, and that's like a thing that actors do. It's funny when you think about it. Our favorite performances are often actors performing in ways that no human would ever behave. They always over-emote, over-express themselves because they're really trying to communicate something to the audience without using words. And he underplays. He's a more subtle actor.
He's not the subtle actor in the Godfather films. In the first one especially, he's only at the end of two briefly. But compared to Robert Duvall, for example, and even Pacino in the first film, especially in the second one, but especially the first one where they're so underplaying, Caan's the one who's big and over the top. So maybe that's why they cast him. It could have been a budgetary thing, too. I think of all those names you mentioned, there's some damn good ones in there. Kevin Kline or William Hurt are the ones I find the most interesting possibilities. Or even Dreyfuss, who knew Reiner from before and was briefly in Stand By Me. You're not a Dreyfuss fan, but he would have been a curious choice, too.
Even though I hate Dreyfuss.
Bates could annihilate him in a fight.
Kevin Kline is the one, I agree with you, that is the one of these names that really jumped out at me of who I would have loved to see do that part.
Kevin Kline's one of those actors that makes everything better. So Misery is three things. She's the girl in the book, Misery, Jessica Chastain. She's Annie's pig, we see once or twice. And of course, Paul is in Misery. He's miserable. It's pretty clever. That's King, of course, writing that in the book.
The book has some beautiful writing about pain and pain medication. He writes in great detail about the ebbs and flows of how the medication makes you feel. What is she giving him? Like Vicodin or something?
Novril. I'm not sure that's real, but that's what they call it.
I'm sure
it.
It's like meant to be an opiate. How awful the pain is and the relief of the medication and that kind of push and pull. He's a recovering addict in the film, isn't he?
I thought maybe he's supposed to be an alcoholic, but I don't know if that's the case necessarily, because it sounds like he doesn't smoke except for when he finishes a book, and she knows that, one of the many things about him that she knows. And that's so key for the ending scene in this movie. I don't know for sure if he's supposed to be an alcoholic. I get the feeling that he is, but I'm not really totally sure about that. But probably in the book, that would make sense. That's a recurring theme. Look, of course, at Jack Torrance in The Shining, recovering alcoholic, and imagines he's drunk in that movie. One of the great touches in The Shining.
You said Annie Wilkes is a metaphor for his drug addiction? When King was writing the book, that's how
I think alcoholism specifically.
I've never heard that before. That is such an interesting read.
Yeah. And also the subtext too, the fans, those multiple subtexts. I'm dealing with this thing that I'm doing to myself. No one else is doing this to me. But the other thing is the thing I can't control, which is you must, if you're famous like he is and as successful as he is, and Khan would have experienced this too with the Godfather movies, and Bates maybe to some degree after this movie did. Anybody who gets famous at all probably experiences this, which is, I love that people love what I do, but leave me the fuck alone. I'm eating dinner, or I'm out with my kids, or don't badger me online all the time. It's one thing to be on Twitter or Facebook as a famous person and interact with fans, and I'm sure they have lots of good interactions, but they probably have so many from people who are either doing the whole thing, like in The Simpsons, you played the cat's ribcage this way, are we supposed to believe that's real, that kind of stuff. Hey, I'm a well-actually guy. I literally put that on our website whenever there's corrections that need to be made on the website. But those kinds of people must drive you crazy. And then what's going on here, of course, is the ones where you have to worry, are they actually going to hurt me or even kill me? Speaking of that, I wonder if Annie really would have taken him to the hospital if she hadn't read the newest book where he does kill off Misery. If she didn't die, then was Annie going to do that? Probably not. But it's a subtext we'll never know, because you dirty bird. And then that's when it's really on. She breaks a stool over his head. She could have killed him right there. It looks like she's about to kill him right there. That's when Khan does sell that he's afraid. But he's also still so vulnerable. He must be a tough bastard, Paul Sheldon, too, because he stops taking those pills, the Novril, long before he probably should have stopped taking them, so he can stash them along with the knife. He's got a lot of things stashed in that bed. There's one of the nice touches in this movie that he has the whole thing with the drugs and then her drink, but it doesn't work. What if it had? He still couldn't drive. He couldn't drag himself out of there. Another few weeks or months. I don't know how long he's supposed to be in her house. It looks like it's at least months. But how is he going to get out of there? He knows he can't call anybody. If he knocks her out, he's not going to kill her, I don't think. Does he tie her up? Okay, fine. He could find food and make it work for a few days and hope somebody comes to look for her. But she doesn't have a job. She only leaves when she really needs or wants to. The movie doesn't need to answer that question because, of course, she spills the wine completely accidentally. Did not mean to save her own life right there or save herself from being knocked out. Maybe he wasn't going to poison her exactly. But I did wonder that question. What would he have done if that stuff had worked?
I wonder that, too. The way that his predicament is drawn, it's so clever because it is a perfect trap. He does not have a way out, and she knows that, and that's why somebody as physically weak as her, although she's pretty strong, but...
She's not weak? What are you talking about?
No, she's not weak, but she's a woman. Normal circumstances, she would never have that much power over him.
I feel like Kathy Bates healthy against James Caan healthy. That's a relatively fair fight. He wins, but it's closer than you think.
I'm sure it's just a convincing performance on her part, but she really does convince you that she could hurt you.
She also says in the scene where she gets so mad at him for killing off Misery, if I die, you die. So that's a hell of a good setup. That's probably in the trailer. I don't remember exactly. That could have been, well, it's not really a famous line, but that could have been nominated for the quotes list too, because it is so key to the whole movie. There are a couple of great ruses in this movie, one by Khan, one by Bates. When he shows her that the paper she got smudges by writing smudge and then smudging it, that causes another freak out. Mr. Man! What a great insult. But it's a good ruse because it's true. He just proved to her that this paper's not going to last. We want paper that's going to last. But that allows him to get out of the place when she has to go off to town. And that's when he does the first snoop around and trying to find out. Well, first of all, he's looking for a phone. But for whatever reason, she has a phone sitting there that doesn't actually have any guts in it. But her great ruse is on Buster when he comes into her house and she's taken Paul down to the basement to stash him and also drugged him so he can't make any noise. Although he does make noise, which is why Buster finds him. But when she tells Buster that she's writing in that front room, I'm going to be the next Paul Sheldon. God told me to be his replacement. What a good cover-up.
such a great story. And you never think that she would be that capable of coming up with something. But this is a woman who got away with what looks like a dozen murders.
Also a serial killer. I said that.
She's a serial killer.
Silence of the Lambs is a serial killer movie. Well, yeah. So is this.
When she was a nurse, she killed all these babies. She killed her husband. They couldn't convict her. They didn't have enough evidence, but everybody more or less thought it was her. And she got away with it. Although, I have to wonder, in this small Colorado town, how the only cop in town doesn't know that he's a serial killer living in his town.
Well, it might have been many years before. She may have moved.
Well, it would make sense she would move to town because she learned that Paul wrote there. What a coincidence it would be if he just happened to always write in the same town that she lived in. She never talks about it, but I presume that she bought that house and moved there just so she could stalk him.
And of course, it's Colorado because most of King's stories were set in either Colorado or Maine, because he also would vacation in Colorado, probably to write. This guy never stops writing, it seems, even when he got hurt and nearly died in that car accident, meaning Stephen King. He still kept writing. Now he's writing with his son, but he's from Maine, and most books and then a lot of the movies are set there, or they're in Colorado, like The Shining is. Well, we said before about Reiner being out of his element, but being pretty good at the tension in this movie, and a classic example is when Con is rolling around in the wheelchair in that house, and then she's coming home, but he's got to race back in the room, and the great cross-cutting as well. Robert Layton cut this movie. He has worked on a lot of movies that we've covered. Stand By Me, Bull Durham, which of course isn't Reiner, but that was between Stand By Me and When Harry Met Sally, which is such an efficient film like you talked about.
Yep.
And then eventually, a great example of editing is knowing this factoid that they had hours and hours, something like 90 hours or whatever it was, 80, whatever it was, maybe 50 hours of footage for Best in Show, which is a 90-minute movie, one of the great comedies of all time. But obviously, Layton would have known, well, probably at least known Christopher Guest through Rob Reiner.
So what's his name again? Layton?
Robert Layton.
Okay, he's my new favorite guy.
And he was nominated for A Few Good Men's editing, which is also quite good.
Now, all these films you're naming are outstandingly edited films.
So an underrated guy in the field.
An underrated skill to be able to tell a story like that, especially Best in Show. That is almost an impossible task, or it can really feel that way. Although I think cutting a documentary probably is a similar set of skills that you would call upon to just take a bunch of random footage and create a story out of it. It sounds like it was shot the same way a documentary would be shot.
So we see quite a bit of Buster through the film. He has nothing else to do, I guess, in this small town except fend off his wife. He is supposed to be trying to find this guy who's gone missing. He's presumed dead, meaning Paul, but Buster doesn't think he is dead when he sees how the car's been broken into with a crowbar and the door and everything. While Paul faces the dilemma of every writer, forget Annie for a minute, just the blank page when he writes fuck, 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 fuck repeatedly. And he has to deal with somebody who, as I said a minute ago, again, forgetting her insanity, knows more than him. But there's also got to be a perverse pleasure with dealing with somebody who loves your work that much. I said a few minutes ago, it's got to be annoying when the fans will, actually you to death. But at the same point that they know your work that well, it's got to be some coolness to that. Galaxy Quest is one of the great fan movies of all time, right? This is, I guess, on that list too.
But the darker side, the more insidious side.
Now, as for the hobbling, the most famous scene in the whole film, in King's book, she uses an axe rather than a sledgehammer. She cuts one of his feet right off. I think it's the right one. Anyway, she cuts a foot right off. And this, of course, is the sledgehammer. You see the left one get hit. You don't see the right one get hit, which is really key because you literally want to close your eyes. Maybe you didn't even see the first one. I said, you can watch now because I know from seeing this movie lots of times that they don't show the second one. Great example of economy in filmmaking. Again, you don't need to see both feet get blasted. You know the second one does by his reaction. And also her reaction after she does it, God, I love you, with an orgasmic look on her face. Yeah. She obviously likes inflicting pain, even on somebody that she says she loves. And I think by that point, or soon after, she's telling him, you're going to finish writing this book, and then I'm going to kill you and myself.
The scene makes me lose it. You got to witness this. I've never actually seen the special effect of his ankle getting smashed, because when I get to that part of the film, it is physically impossible for me to open my eyes and look, because the buildup is just so effective. There's so much of that scene that works. Khan's terror and pitiful, helpless bargaining. Maybe that's part of why he plays it chill for so much of the movie, because then by the time he's at this point and then suddenly he drops the machismo, you know? He's afraid to have that level of humility in his performance up until this scene when he completely loses it. And then his fear becomes our fear. And then Bates is the counter. For once, they've traded places because she's the one who has this chilling calm, methodical preparation. And at this point in the film, we've come to realize that Annie cannot be stopped. All of Paul's pleading is useless, and this terrible thing is going to happen. And I can't totally put my finger on what the magic is in this scene. I was thinking about all the sick torture we witnessed on Game of Thrones, a show that we had almost a decade to become attached to the characters, and yet there was never a single scene in that show that ever gave me the secondhand agony that I get from watching Paul having his ankle demolished by
Me when it's the Viper gets his head crushed by the mountain.
I'll keep my eyes open for that scene, but I can't.
I think I did when we rewatched the show earlier this year, but I don't remember if I did or not, and I've deliberately never watched it on YouTube. That sickened me so much. Maybe because of the reaction.
The scream.
Of his sister, lover, whatever she's supposed to be. I guess lover.
Lover.
That's a big part of why.
Although in that show, you could be both, but she's just his lover.
Yeah. But I think the reason why that scene works for you and why it freaks you out so much and why she won the Oscar probably is because she does underplay it so much. And you're right about just being like a Terminator. She absolutely will not stop ever until he is hobbled. And then in her mind, dead, because that's supposed to be coming soon after as well. In The Shining book, he uses a croquet mallet to injure and try to kill people. In the movie, of course, it's an axe. And the reverse is true here. So King writes Misery, whatever, about 10 years after he writes The Shining. And now he's got the axe in the book. That's the torture device. But in the movie of Misery, it's something less lethal, a sledgehammer. And of course, the big fight at the end when he finishes writing Misery Returns, which in the book, apparently he doesn't actually burn. He pretends that he's going to do that. And then assuming he's going to win this fight, he doesn't know if he will, but what has he got to lose if he dies? He doesn't care either way. But he doesn't want what he thinks is actually a pretty good book, even though it's Misery, this romance novel. He doesn't want to do this anymore. But in the movie, it's implying that, no, he really is burning this because, fuck this, I don't want to be part of this anymore. And you're making me? Well, I'm not only going to kill you to get out of this, and also because I'm sick of your shit, but I don't want this to ever exist in the world. You made me burn my book a few months ago or whatever it was, weeks ago, probably months ago. I'm going to burn this book right in front of you. No, not my Misery! But again, that's a play on King and maybe Reiner as well in some ways. The fans won't let them move on to do something different. And in that brutal fight, I'm going to kill you, lying cocksucker! The only time she ever says anything other than Oogie and Dirty Bird and Cock-a-Doody, Christing, Bitchly, those kinds of things which are barely even offensive to a grandmother who's 85 years old, let alone anyone else. Those things are always played off for a little bit of comedy, a lot of comedy, and a little bit of horror. But now, when push comes to shove, she says, lying cocksucker, and really commits to it as well. One thing about her quote-unquote death scene, because she does die twice, it's one of those fake death type things, which is done pretty well. That wasn't maybe quite a cliche in 1990. I was probably getting there, though. But it looks like when he finally does kill her, their nose goes through her brain. And Chris and I did The Last Boy Scout last month, where Bruce Willis kills somebody, Bruce Willis again, by punching the guy's nose through his brain. Well, you can't do that. Like we said in The Last Boy Scout, it's cartilage. It might hurt, but it's not going to kill somebody. But it looks like that's how she dies.
He punched her to death.
What do you think of the big fight at the end and all the subtext there by burning this book?
It's such a clever ploy because it is her weakness in a way, her obsession with the character in the book. My favorite is that he is taking so much pleasure from getting back at her. And his catharsis...
You sick, twisted fuck!
Exactly, shoving the pages. He should just be killing her, but he has to enjoy this moment for a minute. He says, oh, you've been putting me through this. And all of those emotions that he hasn't been able to express are being shoved into her mouth with a fist. You as the audience are like, kill this bitch already! You want her to die so bad. And you are enjoying that same catharsis that he's enjoying. And we kind of learn in the little epilogue that he is pretty much PTSD. He needs to talk to somebody. He's got to work through these demons now because who wouldn't be traumatized by what he went through? But yeah, my favorite part of that scene is just the passion that he puts into killing her and the catharsis when it's over.
It's a dirty, ugly fight too, which is very appropriate for him still injured. He's still got bad legs. When he tries to trip her, well, he does trip her. He has to use his arms with his own leg. He has to use it like it's a fulcrum or something like that, his leg, that is, because his leg still doesn't work on its own. And then it seems like he's going through one hell of a long recovery process when he gets back to New York and back to normal. He's walking with a cane and probably for the rest of his life.
Well, it's 18 months later. If he's still walking with a cane, he's never going to lose that cane.
You talked about PTSD. When he sees that dessert waitress, if she had said, I'm your number one fan, then he looked up and saw Kathy Bates' face there, that'd be one thing. But he envisions Kathy Bates walking along before she even says anything.
Maybe he sees that look of adoration in that woman's face. Probably something he saw 100 times before he ever had that experience. He knows a devoted fan when he sees one. He just sees that expression on her face, and it brings him right back to that room and brings all that trauma back.
And his agent wants him to write about it, but he doesn't think he can ever do that, understandably. That would be one hell of a story, because, of course, that's what we see in this movie. It's that story.
We know it's one hell of a story.
Because we watched it. Yeah, we're talking about it right this second.
It's a blockbuster film. Well, maybe blockbuster is strong, but it was a very successful film.
We talked about the play that Willis and the Tony-nominated, in fact, Laurie Metcalf. She was nominated for a Tony for that.
For the heiress, or not the heiress, for A Doll's House Part 2. a play that we saw, but not with her in it.
No, I mean, Laurie Metcalf was nominated for a Tony for Misery.
Well, she was also nominated for Dollhouse Part 2. I think she won it, as a matter of fact.
Okay. The other connections with very famous films, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane? Kathy Bates is the Betty Davis character, and Joan Crawford is the equivalent of Jimmy Caan.
Good point. Yeah, that is a good comparison.
And then, of course, Sunset Boulevard is a great example of this, too. A mad woman imprisons a hack writer because Paul Sheldon, we don't know if that book that she made him burn was good, but his Misery books are romance novels. They're fun. They can be pretty sexy, but they're hack. I've read some of them over the years when I was younger. My sister would have them and I'd read them, especially the ones that are hot. Read some of those.
Smut. It's called smut.
Yeah, but I don't like what he's writing as smut exactly, because I think of the Heaven series, if people know what I'm talking about, with the Misery thing. And those would describe sex, but not as graphic as, I think Pat Booth is the writer I'm thinking of, that would describe it almost like it's porn, but it wasn't actually porn. But the Heaven series would have sexual scenes and the kind of things that I'm sure are in the Misery novels, but they're not graphic exactly either. So here's a hack writer, like in Sunset Boulevard. William Holden's character is not that talented in the first place, and he's imprisoned by a mad woman, and they have this bizarre codependent relationship. Now, he can leave, and at the end he tries to leave, but then I guess he can't leave because she shoots him, as does Kathy Bates with Jimmy Caan in this movie. She does shoot him, just doesn't hit him in the head or anything that's all that vital. Hits him in the shoulder or something. We said there's pretty much five actors in the whole movie. Richard Farnsworth is Margie. In a lot of ways, he's like Margie in Fargo.
Oh, yeah, totally. That's my car.
And I love him in The Natural, which was about 6 years before this. He's wonderful in The Straight Story. He was nominated for that.
Yeah.
Maybe even should have won that year. That was the last movie he ever did. He had cancer and killed himself. But when he was in movies, he didn't act a ton. He was a stuntman for a long time. Then he started acting. He's damn good. A great example is this. His chemistry with Frances Sternhagen. They aren't on screen much together, but they're great. She, of course, is Cliff's mom on Cheers.
And I just have to say, because we've been talking about theater so much, I saw her in a play on Broadway when I was a teenager on a school trip.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, she was in The Heiress.
We've talked about Reiner's great credits already. He also does play the helicopter pilot. We see a few times. No dialogue. He barely does anything at all. He's a good actor, though, too, especially when he wasn't directing himself. I think he's been in some of his movies as an actor that he's directed. But when he acts for other people, case in point, outstanding example of it would be Marty Scorsese in Wolf of Wall Street. Probably should have gotten nominated for the Oscar for that. He's outstanding as DiCaprio's father. The writer William Goldman won two Oscars in his past. Not for this movie, of course. Wasn't even nominated for the screenplay. And I don't think it should have been, exactly. And as you said, he did write The Princess Bride, his own book. He adapted that for Reiner. And that was his previous screenplay before this. So two in a row were Reiner movies. And King sold the rights with the proviso that Reiner be involved, at least as a producer, but ideally as a director. He wanted Reiner specifically because he loved what Reiner did with Stand By Me. And the producers were Reiner himself and Andy Scheinman, who often worked with Rob on Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, and was one of the nominees for Best Picture on A Few Good Men. We watched the DVD, like I said, that we own. The movie's 185-1. The cinematographer, Barry Sonnenfeld. We talked about him. The editor, Robert Layton. We loved him. And the music, Mark Shaiman. His first ever movie was this one. We covered South Park not that long ago. That was an Oscar nominee for him for the song. He's been nominated 7 times over the years and has often worked with Rob Reiner. I guess we talked about the editing. We loved that. But what did you think of the look? And apart from the Kathy Bates stuff you thought was tipping the hand a little too much, what do you think of the cinematography otherwise and, of course, the music?
The cinematography is fine. It's kind of boilerplate. Doesn't really get in its own way. The editing, love, considering the difficulty of keeping a movie interesting when it has such a limited space and people. It's not a very traditional story arc, and yet it never loses momentum. I didn't like the score at all, so I'm so sorry, Shaiman. I love lots of things that he does. I think he's incredible. But this score was a little heavy-handed for me. Maybe it's just because, as I said, it blew its load too early in the first act of the film. Yeah.
I think he was nominated for The American President, a Reiner movie again, and one of the more underrated ones in Reiner's filmography. You know, one thing I'll say before we wrap here? Interesting choice about using Jimmy Caan, who wasn't as well-known as he had been in the 70s. Also, Brian's Song. I think it was a TV movie before the Godfather films. And there's other things, I'm sure. I didn't write all of his credits down. But he was a pretty well-known guy there for a while, arguably really famous because of The Godfather and then Godfather Part II. But if you had cast Redford, if you'd cast Nicholson or Beatty, realistically, they're not going to die. But James Caan, maybe this is one of those kinds of movies, which you'd see more often now, actually, maybe does die. And she probably does, too. Or it could be one of those movies where she does kill him and then she's out to not deliberately kill somebody again, but she gets away scot-free yet again.
That's an advantage of casting non-stars in roles, is it does reintroduce peril. That's a really good point.
Okay, then. We're now officially in October, so Scary Movie Month is 2 weeks in, but only one day in October so far for us. What are your last thoughts on Misery, our second, not really a horror film, more of a thriller, as was Repulsion. What are your last thoughts on Misery?
So I think I have to plagiarize the late, great Roger Ebert's final words from his 3-star review. That just sums it up better than I ever could. It doesn't illuminate, challenge, or inspire, but it works.
I like the number rating more than the star rating because I want to give it more than 3 out of 4 for stars. I think I'd rather give it more like an 8 out of 10 in a strange way. It sounds like you and he, meaning Ebert, would be 7s, I would argue, out of 10, right? And I'm more like an 8 at least. I think because it's funnier than I remembered it being. Maybe that's because it's a comedy director. One thing we didn't talk about too, when Bates turns around sometimes and you see her eyes, that 1,000-yard stare type thing, she had to know that was funny. Reiner had to know that was funny. But it is creepy and weird, too. We see some of the same things in a different way, because that movie's not funny at all. Repulsion, where Catherine Deneuve, I think I said to you during the screening of Repulsion, that Catherine Deneuve, I could see playing an outright villain. Yeah, she's a villain, but somebody who's supposed to be all along a villain, because she's got great big eyes. And what a difference, too, because Catherine Deneuve is a supermodel at 21 years old in that movie, and Kathy Bates was never a supermodel. Catherine, 2 straight weeks. And as I said before, every movie we're covering for this month, last month, is included with Repulsion, has a female antagonist, and arguably a female lead. That certainly is in a Repulsion and Misery. She shares the spotlight with James Caan. Okay, we'll be off next week because October 12th is a Canadian Thanksgiving.
It's Canucksgiving.
Will we be eating turkey with the family? I don't know. Virus! When we kick things back into gear on the 19th, we'll head over to Japan and look at Takashi Miike's graphically violent 20-year-old horror flick, Audition. And if foot trauma bothered you in Misery, you may regret watching Audition. I thought about maybe watching something else instead for you. But we do have a nice theme as well with the one-word titles this month. Repulsion, Misery, Audition, and then, of course, still. I think I mentioned already we're going to do Us, another woman antagonist. The coming attractions opinion for Audition. What movie had a scene so horrifying, so hard to watch, that you never saw that movie again?
So for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Audition. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 07 lists of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles. In exchange for all this content, you can leave us a rating and a review. And you can reach us both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. And that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. And it's not case sensitive. And that will get you a 20% discount.
With respect to our sponsor, I think I need something a little more strong than coffee. So let's go celebrate another successful episode with a bottle of Dom Perignon.
And cut.